Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Al Nettleton, a longtime member of the Society, and we want to let you know that Prairie works hard to be a welcoming congregation, and we welcome people of all faith backgrounds, people of all sexual family backgrounds, and those that are interested in exploring their own minds for the religion that they feel is appropriate to them. So our opening words are from Dorothy Day. People say, "What is the sense of our small effort?" They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There is too much work to be done. Our presenter this morning is Alexa Kolodzic, and she is an associate professor in the Wisconsin UW School of Workers for Workers, and she's also a board member of the Worker Justice Wisconsin. Worker Justice Wisconsin has its offices in the Labor Temple on Park Street. It was established in 2018 through a merger of the Interfaith Coalition of Worker Justice for Southern Wisconsin, South Central Wisconsin, and the Workers' Rights Center. From their statement of purpose, we believe that worker justice is necessary for a just economy. We build collective worker power through training, labor rights education, collective education, and community engagement with an emphasis on interfaith involvement. We seek to mobilize the religious and labor communities of South Central Wisconsin on worker rights issues, to actively build relationships between faith and labor groups, and to support the rights of workers to organize and engage in collective bargaining. So, Alexa.
Thank you all so very much for having me. I really do appreciate it on this Labor Day weekend, which is such an important time for so many of us. So, you know, as I've been introduced, my name is Alexia, and I work both at the UW School for Workers and sit on the board of Worker Justice Wisconsin, both organizations of which I'm involved in labor education, the study of labor studies, and worker justice generally. So I can tell from this morning's resounding chorus of Solidarity Forever that you probably know a little bit about the labor movement and probably have a sense that, in fact, it's a good idea for us to continue having unions. Nonetheless, I do have a few things to say about that. But the very first thing I want to say, something I was thinking about this morning, is when we talk about people wanting to be in a union or having a collective bargaining agreement, all they really want is a fair day's wage for fair work, right? Fair wages for hard work. That's what we're looking for, right? And I will counterpose that with the statistic that in the United States, on average today, workers are losing $8 billion in wage theft. So in other words, just not getting paid the wages that they're owed for their hard work. I think this is something in particular that worker justice works on, and I'll talk about that again in a few minutes. But I think those two things is, you know, wanting that collective bargaining agreement in place is one of the ways to ensure that we will decrease the amount of wages lost each year in just plain old wage theft or workers not receiving their monies for being paid. So that's a cheery way to start, but that kind of really points out the necessity, I think, and the problems and the challenges facing workers today in this country. I'll then turn, before I get into the little bit of historic perspective that I wish to bring a happier note, is as we are here on Labor Day and celebrating both the accomplishments of organized labor as well as workers generally, part of that recognition and celebration I don't know why I'm leaning. There's nothing here. kind of a habit, I guess. The recognition that what labor unions have, in fact, brought us are the what I will call the few, frankly, worker protections that we do have in this country. Our minimum wage and our overtime laws were very much because of the union involvement in the legislature passing that, right? The eight-hour workday, having workers' compensation. Incidentally, did you know Wisconsin was the first state to have a workers' compensation statute? Yeah, way back when, Wisconsin really cared about workers. Isn't that fantastic? Lunch breaks, minimum wage, overtime, and something even more recent that I will include, which was 1992, the passage of the Family Medical Leave Act. Also very much because of union involvement in political activity and in legislative work. So there is an awful lot to celebrate in terms of what has been accomplished by unions. What I tell students very often is those are all statutory, right? They're not embedded in the Constitution. They're not embedded in anything that cannot be changed. And so when I hear the argument that, oh, yes, of course we needed those unions, things were horrible, but now we have all these things. We have a minimum wage that hasn't been changed in decades. We have overtime rights, and we have some kind of health and safety laws, and there are some things in place to help protect workers. That is all true, but it is all legislation that can be changed depending on who is in the administration. And so those rights are not something that we can give up on or believe that they will continue into infinity, right? That's just not the case. So before I talk a little bit about Worker Justice Wisconsin, which is one of the reasons that's really brought me here today, I thought I would take a step back. First, I say that we are here this weekend and today to celebrate what workers do for this country and what labor, I think, has brought in terms of worker justice in this country. And I think that's a great celebration and very important. There's a couple of different theories about the origins of Labor Day and why we do it at this time of year or, where this really came from. In terms of the September date, there's some argument that some labor leaders had just chosen that they wanted some kind of an end of summer time to celebrate labor. There have been theories that the Knights of Labor in New York City had a very large march back in the late 1800s on September 4th, I believe. Let's see if I wrote down that date. No, of course not, because that's not the theory I go with. So, sometime in the late 1800s that there was a march in New York, and so celebrating labor's accomplishments sort of attached to the time of that march was relevant. But I think that the most prevalent and one that's near and dear to my heart and the one that I think you hear most often is that it's connected to the Haymarket Square riots in Chicago, Illinois in 1886. Now, that actually occurred in May of 1886 and not September, and became International Workers' Day and International Labor's Day, celebrating and embracing what workers have gone through to be able to have rights in the workplace. How that then later became the September date is really still up to some debate, but I do think that the Haymarket Square riots was kind of a starting place for our celebration of labor and its accomplishments. And I don't only say that because I'm from Chicago, right? But but the Haymarket Square riots were about protesters simply in a peaceful manner wishing to bring attention to the need for an eight-hour day, right? I mean, I think some of the lyrics we talked about in Solidarity Forever talks about the endless toil and the number of hours that people were working. At that time, the average worker in this country was working about 12 hours a day, and children as young as 5 and 6 were working at the time. And so the workers had another big issue was lack of sanitation, et cetera. So just a quick refresher on the Haymarket. I can tell that I'd want to take more time than I really should, so I'm going to speed it up a little bit here. But the central focus of those protests were, in fact, the eight-hour day. And as many of you may recall, May of 1886, of course, the police in Chicago were trying to stop the protest. They were not in agreement with the protest for the eight-hour day. Several protesters were killed. Several policemen were killed. And, of course, there was an unknown bomb that killed several of the policemen, for which later 7 people were arrested, 4 were hanged, 2 were later pardoned, and 1 committed suicide without any evidence that these were, in fact, the protesters that threw the bomb that led to the death of the police officers in Chicago. And this really did become, I think, the starting place, or in a lot of ways at least a symbol of what American workers have to go through for something as simple as a reasonable number of hours of work in a day, a reasonable pay for their work, and to be able to work in fresh conditions. One of the things that was going on in the late 1800s at that time was really widespread income inequality. So not only were wages and conditions bad, but one of the things here, right, was that the very rich owned the operations where workers worked, and the very poor worked in the operations. And what I find most disturbing about that, of course, is the parallel that we are now seeing today, right? That today, 1/4 of all U.S. workers earn less than $10 an hour, which is below our poverty level, that the top 10% of wage earners are earning 50% of all income in this country, and that the top 1% are earning 20% of all income in this country. And that's income. That's not necessarily wealth. That's wage income or 1099, you know, independent contractor income. That's not necessarily wealth from other places. So in so many ways, we are getting dangerously close to what led us to strikes and protests in the late 1800s that led to some of those protections. One thing that did happen as a result of those actions in the late 1800s and early 1900s were that unions, in fact, were strengthened, right? And we heard again in the lyrics, in the introduction, talking about collective activity. And the strength of people coming together to protect one another has always done so much more for workers' rights, really, than any legislation or any policies or any rules that can be put in place. So by the late 1800s, early 1900s, our unions were actually quite strong. And it was not a pretty sight back then. For many of the strikes and protests that took place were, in fact, very violent. The working conditions really did not allow for any kind of healthy conditions, long hours, children still working. At about the time of the New Deal, was the time unions had become actually fairly strong and pretty effective. And when I say effective, they were able to shut down job sites in order to try to get their collective bargaining agreements and improve conditions. They didn't improve dramatically, but they were able to secure collective bargaining agreements and secure some sort of fair wages for their accomplishments. This led in part to the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. I say in part because, as I often teach my students, in 1935, people weren't sitting back saying, you know what, workers really need some better protections. Let's pass this law saying that they can organize. They were already organizing. They didn't need a law to tell them to organize. They were organizing, right? And so the preamble of the law actually says that it was being passed in order to continue the flow and promote commerce in the country. So in other words, we don't want workers out striking for good benefits. We want to create some sort of dispute resolution mechanism, let them have collective bargaining agreements so that we can keep the railroads running as well as other businesses. To some extent, there was even some logic to that as we were coming out of the Great Depression, and we did, in fact, want to make sure that businesses were running and that workers were treated fairly and we could work on the economy to fix the economy. But in any case, one thing I talk a lot about is the National Labor Relations Act that was passed in 1935, and at least in the language of the act, gives workers the right to engage in protected activity and have collective bargaining agreements. What I think is so special about this law, not to be sort of a geeky academic legal person, is it's the one law about worker rights in this country that is about the collective. The whole point of the National Labor Relations Act is to protect workers' ability to come together collectively to voice their opinions and to have a voice in the workplace and to obtain certain benefits. And so that the law still protects that collective activity, and workers, whether they're union or not, still have the ability to use that law to engage in their rights, to protect their rights. So the one thing that I will, one other thing I did want to sort of point out here, yes, what did I want to point out? When I'm talking about income inequality and the problems that that brings, I'm not actually that short, I'm just a little short, and the problems that that brings is that collective bargaining and that having that union contract in place has historically been the most effective way to combat wage inequality or income inequality in this country. And when I say that the NLRA allows people to engage in that collective activity, that's true, but what most people don't realize is how many people are actually left out of that law. So it sounds great on its face, right? So first and foremost, it does not cover any public sector employees at all. And public sector, frankly, is as you may know, is also under attack right now in terms of their rights to improve conditions and engage in collective activity. So no public sector workers, nobody that the employer can label as a, quote, supervisor or manager level employee, no matter how low a level of manager or just slapping them with that kind of title may be. When an employer chooses to give people be independent contractors so they're not employees on the payroll of the employer, they're not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. So this whole movement of people like our tailor, who had to move from, you know, working for one large employer to produce a great product and now has to go into business for him or herself, or maybe a lot of us are doing something else on the side, this whole gig economy that we're facing in this country, none of that work, or a lot of that work, is not covered by this law that gives them those rights, which is why you see in the newspaper fights about whether Uber employees are employees and whether they can strike, right? Are they covered by this law or not is really the big question when you see stories like this. And so, you know, I would just posit that not enough workers in this country even have the right to engage in this conduct, even though we say that it's their right. That little by little, these rights have been taken away. Little by little, unions' actions in representing these folks and what they can do to represent them and help them get that those collective bargaining agreements, those have been whittled away, right? Unions can't engage in certain activity against anybody other than the employer with whom there's a dispute called secondary activity. So they can't even do that. So even though union density in this country has dramatically fallen, right? So we hear the statistic that in the public sector, I think we're still just above 30%, and in the private sector, about 5.6%. I have the actual number in here somewhere. But it's fallen dramatically, and I would posit not because people don't want to be in a labor union anymore, but because little by little the rights have been taken away, and little by little corporate power and shareholder power has become much more paramount than anything such as workers' rights in this country. And it's not surprising to me that as union density has fallen so dramatically, that that's when we have seen the increase in income inequality in this country, right? And so as somebody who teaches labor educators and labor representatives, union representatives, I can tell you that collective activity and working together to try to enforce these rights is still far more effective than doing anything at the legislative level or with a federal or government agency. But they're still doing it, and we can still have that impact. Which leads me to my second hat that really brings me here to speak with you all today, and that is an organization called Worker Justice Wisconsin. So labor unions and collective bargaining agreements are a very effective way of combating this wage theft issue that we have in this country, this income inequality problem we have in this country, but so many workers aren't covered by that, right? And so real briefly, in addition to unions, we've seen an increase in worker centers around the country and organizations and advocates trying to help workers with these problems. I already mentioned that we lose about $8 billion in wage theft every year. Last year at the EEOC, there were approximately 77,000 charges of discrimination filed. 30,000 of those were sexual harassment cases that were filed. And in Wisconsin, workers' compensation, I added together some numbers, about 20,000 cases were filed. So I give those numbers to just say, in addition to other things, discrimination is still a big problem. Harassment is a huge problem. Worker injuries is still an enormous problem. And those figures are only people who bother to stand up and show up and file a complaint, and they chose to do so at a federal agency. That doesn't include state agency statistics or local municipalities or that kind of thing. So it's still an enormous problem, these worker injustices that we're seeing in this country. Here in Wisconsin, there are two organizations. I forget what the first is. I hate when people do that to me. But there's only two workers' rights organizations in the state of Wisconsin working to help the non-unionized worker get the wages that they're owed, learn what their rights are, stand up against discrimination, and that kind of thing. And I'm with one of them, which is called Worker Justice Wisconsin. I highly encourage all of you to take a look at it. It's just workerjusticewisconsin.org. And as was stated earlier, this organization was formed just in January of 18 as a merger between something called the Workers' Rights Center of Madison, which was a straight-up secular organization representing workers, and something called the Interfaith Worker Justice. And that was basically what it sounds like, people of different faiths and community coming together to try to advocate on behalf of mostly low-income workers. Many of the workers that come into the center don't speak English as their first language. And one of the things the organization does, yes, we will help you file a claim with the government if there's been a wrong or wages unpaid, etc. But we feel more important is to go back to those roots of collective activity. And so the one thing that we do is teach workers how they can come together, engage in direct activities against these employers to collect their wages, go out into the public and speak about the injustices, and just be involved in their community and sharing how these, that what's going on in their communities in terms of wages not being paid, discrimination, et cetera. Again, trying to build up this power that we sang about this morning. Doesn't have to be under a formal traditional labor union, but people just coming together to protect people. And so that is what we do try to do at the organization Worker Justice Wisconsin. So I am here today because of that interfaith, and by the way, both of those organizations existed for years and years. We just finally came together and decided we should just be one organization doing this work. Like this congregation, right? It's a group of people of many diverse opinions, ideologies, philosophies, who all feel that what we need to do is make sure that people continue or try to make sure that people can get those wages, fair wages for a hard day's work, that's what it's all about. I was invited here as part of this Labor in the Pulpit series to be able to just bring these issues around to the public and to the community. And thankfully, you know, we have several people in the faith community on our board that were involved in setting up some of us coming around and speaking to congregations. So I am so grateful that you did that and had me. I'm also grateful the congregation has made a donation to Worker Justice in the $100 for my speaking here today, and I am just so grateful that this community is supporting this kind of an organization. But I would also like to say I highly encourage, you know, we have a couple of great staff people trying really hard to do all of the education and to be spreading the word and representing workers when these things arise, and it could be a real challenge. So I highly encourage all of you to just take a look at Worker Justice Wisconsin. Consider giving. That will help us keep enforcing workers' rights today. So, yeah. Yeah, and in many other countries, in particular Western Europe, and I guess this is true in Japan, I wasn't really aware of that, but they have what's called industry-wide bargaining. And so all workers are covered, and folks in the industry, commerce, and the union will bargain to set the terms and conditions. In the United States, we have more employment-based collective bargaining, and it tends to be job site by job site by job site, which, one, you know, definitely is, I mean, I think it was intentional, because by decentralizing the power of the union, it really hurt the union's ability to continue to have power and to have any say-so in that worksite. But one thing that we've seen is with all of the consolidation amongst corporate America, so now you have, you know, you might work in a shipyard in Marinette, Wisconsin, where there's a few hundred people, but you're owned by an Italian company, and so doing that collective bargaining by this small local union up in Marinette, Wisconsin, is a real challenge to accomplish anything. I just throw them out as an example because I saw them recently. But anyway, great question. Theoretically, our employment laws protect undocumented immigrants, and they should feel free to go forward to a government agency, make a claim, and get paid. I do say theoretically, because while they could do that and get paid, there used to be a couple of agreements between the Department of Labor specifically and like Customs and Immigration Enforcement that they wouldn't share, hey, we found this person that may or may not be documented, when they came to make a claim. That's no longer the case. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, there at least was some recognition that we wouldn't share amongst agencies if that has been suspected, so that workers could enforce their rights. That's no longer true, so there is no protection to say, yes, you can come forward and get your pay, but next week the employer can call the federal agencies and you're not necessarily protected against deportation. So, yes, that's a huge problem. Our undocumented workforce, while it's theoretically covered by some of these laws, will not come forward and use that as the mechanism to enforce their rights, unfortunately. Yeah, well, the source that I used for that was a report that was published by the Economic Policy Institute, and I believe they relied on data published by the U.S. Department of Labor, the Bureau, BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics. So that's kind of the federal agency that tracks and tries to collect statistics. And I would imagine what I understand from the studies that have been done is that it includes wages that have never been paid, wages that have been paid short. Maybe you've worked all the hours and you've been paid for the hours, but at no overtime rate. So it's supposed to include everything that wasn't paid that should have been. In terms of the how they collected the information, I think there's a variety of methods that organizations that work with people have reported these numbers to the Department of Labor. Some have been filed by complaints and compiling the complaints against employers, and the Department of Labor keeps those numbers. One real problem with some of the wage theft is a lot of them are small employers that once there's a claim filed, they tend to disappear, right? They open as another company or something like that. So the DOL will have data that people have complained and showed evidence that they're owed money, but now the company's not there to go after. So, I got it from the Economic Policy Institute, has a great report on this, but I think they relied on BLS data. No, I mean, that's absolutely true. I start so many of my classes saying, do we have a right to organize in this country? Everyone says yes. And then I say, have we always had a right to organize in this country? And they all say no, right? Before the law specifically said we had the right, we were organizing and we did it. And there was nothing prohibiting it. Now, what they did was they came after us for, you know, alleged criminal conspiracies and antitrust and things that today they can't come after workers for. So, yes, workers can organize. They may not have a federally protected right in a lot of places or a public sector labor law that helps them, but there's nothing saying thou shalt not engage in collective activity, right? Like, you can still organize. And, you know, particularly as Wisconsin went right to work and as other states have faced this, what you see from a demoralized workforce is there's nothing we can do. And what I try to tell them is, yeah, I know it stinks to be right, you know, a right-to-work state here in Wisconsin, which just means that you don't have to pay union dues, but you get representation. But you can still organize and engage in that collective activity. So I try to break people out of that mold of, you know, the regulations are in place to protect you, and it's up to us as a people together to come together as a community to fight back. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Because I sometimes share that same concern. What I would say
And this is true, by the way. It doesn't have to be just police unions right. and racist. I've heard it in education where they say this horrible teacher is in place and we can't get rid of them, blah, blah, blah. What I would say is when it comes to a worker or a workforce that is not ideal, that is not, in fact, just doing their job and working hard and trying to get their fair wages for it, that the employer is responsible for ensuring that the workforce is doing what they should and should not be doing, and that the union is in place to ensure a fair process. So if an employer investigates, for example, whether it's a teacher or a police officer, etc., at least how it should work, the employer investigates, the union protects that individual's right to be treated fairly through the investigation, has due process, gets to share their side of the story, any other thoughts or evidence they may have to help. But then if, in fact, it's appropriate, the employer needs to take action against that person. And I think that's how it should be, and I've worked with and for many unions where we have those bad actors, and a case is put in front of us, and we say, that person really deserved to be fired, right? And you don't go forward and challenge that. I will say that I share your concern with the police unions. There was one thing that came up quite recently that, you know, I think just always protecting, quote, your own without looking at the circumstances does the union a disservice, because then it makes people think you're not, you know, you're just protecting your own and you're not looking at society as a whole and society at large. And what I'd rather see is, you know, the vast majority of our members are hardworking police officers here to protect you. And yeah, once in a while, there's going to be a bad actor. And we believe everybody should be treated fairly, regardless of race or income level, et cetera. So they're not perfect institutions and they're run by imperfect people. With imperfect backgrounds. So I do share those concerns. I have seen a number of collective bargaining agreements that the union does represent all permanent and part-time employees in such job classifications, but the union can also enter into a collective bargaining agreement that says that the union represents the full-time employees of such and such. So it strikes me as a creature of contract. This is what probably the union and the employer agreed to, and or, if you could go back to the origins of when they first organized, it was the full-time people who wanted it, and maybe everybody agreed at the time that, you know, that's the unit that they chose to organize. In other words, whether it's the union or the employer fought back on that, you know, it's, you can choose sort of who you're trying to represent at the time you first organized. Or, but then when you're first sitting at the contract, sitting down to negotiate, you know, you might have that problem. I've also seen, if in case you wanted to get involved with your union, I've also seen that unions could say something like, we represent everyone, but when it comes to certain things like health benefits or the vacation, et cetera, there's different sets of rules for permanent and full part-time people, right? That it doesn't have to be you're in the contract or you're not. You can have, you can delineate that in the agreement.
You can ask to see that.
Well, that's a very good start. Yes, you have a right to the contract. Well, you don't because you're not in the union. Anybody in your, a union? Let me rephrase, and I don't know that I made this clear, but I have a legal background before I started teaching at UW, so I do get into the weeds a little bit. Everyone should ask for a copy of their contract and should, in my opinion, has like a human right to see a copy of what CBA might be at issue in your place. The federal law protects the right of bargaining unit members to see it and to get a copy of it, which is people covered by the agreement.
Uh-huh.
But I would just ask someone that's covered to say, hey, ask the union for a copy of it, and that would be the end of it, right? But deserve is kind of a strong word. I think that I can accept the argument that a top manager, owner, developer, somebody with the vision, somebody with the hard work behind them in starting an organization and starting a business, that those skills may warrant a higher salary than rank and file. That much I think I can agree with. I think where I would disagree is in two places. One is how many people the employers and the government would label supervisor so that they don't have any rights under the act. So in other words, if you're someone that's been given like a title of lead person and all you're doing is, you know, the big boss told me to come tell you guys what to do all day,
I don't have any real power, right? I don't think, and so what I'm saying is that person should still be able to have a collective bargaining agreement, and maybe they would have a different wage rate. And the other thing that I would say in response is maybe some income inequality is, quote, fair if we're judging it on merit in education and how hard someone works, et cetera. I do not believe that the degree of income inequality that we are facing in this quality in this country can in any way be described as those folks, quote, deserving that higher income. And one of the strong reasons I feel this way is that the reason the corporation or an entity may be making the kind of profits that they are is on the backs of labor, right? And it may be because of cutting some other things like environmental protections or health and safety protections or the wages involved. And so, yes, maybe they would be deserving of more, but in a world where they were following everything appropriately, then they probably wouldn't have quite as high a profit, and we probably wouldn't have quite as great of a gap. No, it's a great point and a great question. Two things. One is that I believe, and I too, by the way, have worked for SEIU, so I believe one of the reasons that SEIU is growing is, in fact, its enormous attention to and putting of resources into organizing. There's no doubt about it. But there's a second reason, I think, why SEIU is one of the few unions growing, and that is because they represent service workers. It's Service Employees International Union. And so it used to be, you know, your carpenters or your UAW members, your auto workers, that were your more stereotypical folks organized in the union. And what we've seen, you know, like in the book with the tailor, where the work went away, now we've got good, highly educated jobs here and everybody that's working for them. And so the service sector has really taken off. So I think I applaud the union for organizing those folks, but I also think it's partly because the number of jobs in that industry, if you will, has skyrocketed so much in this country. So there's so many service workers to be organized. What are other unions doing? It depends, right? I think all unions need to really be trying to organize. I think a good number of them are trying really hard and not necessarily successfully. And so the fact that we haven't seen the numbers get any better is not necessarily in response to them not doing anything, because I see a lot of them trying. But it's that we've reached this point where, you know, people don't have faith in the institution, or they're so intimidated at their place of employment to not support joining a union and bringing in a union in that place that the union is not successful. Now, that's not entirely the reason. I've also seen, for example, here in Wisconsin, after several major anti-worker efforts have gone through, that folks are just it's like they're done. They're demoralized, right? And it's hard to keep fighting when you feel like you've kept losing. And so I think that has posed a real challenge to union organizing. And some unions are not doing what they should be doing. Some are still just trying to protect their own and hang on to what they've got, and they somehow think that's going to be enough. I disagree. I think with that attitude, they'll be gone. Thank you again for having me. What I do want to, and I hear some of your reservations on employees getting their remedies today from a union, from a labor union, and again, an organization that is there fighting for folks that don't have that and want to come together to try to fight back for their rights, Worker Justice Wisconsin. Just take a look. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alexis. Our closing words are from Abraham Lincoln. As labor is the common burden of our race, so is the effort of some to shift their share of the burden onto the shoulders of others is the great durable curse of the race. So greet your neighbors. Thank you for coming this morning.